The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
You know, after struggling to find able workers, I think a lot of employers are reluctant to let them go at the first sign of real softening. So historically, what we see is they get rid of temporary workers, which has already begun. They cut back on overtime hours, which has already begun. The average work week starts to shrink. So in other words, they're addressing labor costs, but they're doing it before they have to actually lay somebody off. Historically, the biggest increase in the unemployment rate doesn't happen until you're well into the recession. So again, that just emphasizes the labor market's a lagging indicator. It's going to take a while, but once the domino starts going, it picks up steam. And I think that's what we're going to see, particularly in the second half of this year and going into next year. This week, Powell was giving a speech and he talked about the Fed's independence and how important it was. And he basically said, we're going to be raising rates, the economy's going to slow, and we're going to be getting blowback politically. And that basically it was imperative that the Fed ignore that political pressure so that they can achieve their goal of bringing inflation down. So he's almost preparing, if you will, the Fed for the political backlash we're going to see if unemployment starts to tick up. So again, all that does is remind me or reinforce my belief that the Fed's resolve is about as strong as it could be. I suspect it's going to remain pretty strong even in the face of some negative unemployment news and negative news on the economy.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up on today's program, we have a fabulous show in store for you. Daniel DiMartino Booth will join us as we talk about Fed policy, and Jim Welsh on inflation and the market. And of course, later on in the program, we will be talking about turbulence and volatility for the balance of this decade as we look at the big picture. But first, let's find out what happened on Wall Street with Ryan Poplava.
2023 continues with a good start to the year in equities and bonds after last year's terrible performance. In just a couple of weeks, the Vanguard Mega Cap Growth ETF is up 5.4%, and the iShares Core U.S. Aggregate Bond ETF is up 3%. That's because interest rates have recently come down as a result of weaker economic data and disinflationary data since the end of 2022. Investors are becoming more comfortable with their current interest rate outlook, which is expecting the Fed will keep rates below 5% despite comments from officials. The recent CME FedWatch tool predictions show we'll see quarter point hikes in February and March, with a 55% chance the March hike will be the last hike this year come the May meeting. The two-year Treasury is a decent predictor as well of Fed rates, and it so far has peaked in early November at 4.75%. And last I looked, it was just under 4.25%. As I mentioned last week, the two-year Treasury yield fell significantly after the contraction data was released for the non-manufacturing ISM in December. Interest rates and inflation are still the focal point for investors, and the data continues to support the consensus that the Fed may be able to pause soon, and in doing so, avoid a hard landing for the economy. Moving on, let's talk about the main catalysts this week, which were a speech by Powell, the consumer price index print on Thursday, and bank earnings on Friday as the earnings season kicks off for the week. On Tuesday, Fed Chair Powell gave a speech titled Central Bank Independence. His comments had little effect on the market, but that's why it was a catalyst. His speech wasn't hawkish, and so it was perceived his goal was not to rein in the stock market. Instead, he said, restoring price stability when inflation is high can require measures that are not popular in the short term as we raise interest rates to slow the economy. And that's basically a depiction of what happened last year. The consumer price index, or CPI, continues to decelerate with year-over-year headline rate that has dropped again from 7.5% in November to a print of just 6.5% in December. The core rate has also dropped from 6% year-over-year down to 5.7%. Overall, these numbers support the ongoing consensus the Fed may be able to stop raising soon. However, inside the report, services ticked up to 7.5% year over year, up from 7.2% in November. The two-year treasury yield was up before the announcement, but fell to 4.11% following the data from 4.3%. Also announced on Thursday was the initial claims report, which came in strong at only 205,000 claims, which continues to point out that the labor market is tight and at this point suggests that a soft landing is the main outlook if unemployment claims do not rise. On the flip side of that coin, it also communicates that service inflation would keep going up if the labor market doesn't soften. This week was the kickoff to the fourth quarter earnings season with the financials on Friday. Quoting from FactSet, the S&P 500 is expected to report a year-over-year decline in earnings of negative 3.9% for the fourth quarter. Over the past two quarters, Q2 and Q3 in 2022, however, actual earnings reported by the S&P 500 companies have exceeded estimated earnings by only 2.5% on average, end quote. I think if the fourth quarter earnings maintains the same pace in surprises, we could have a negative earnings quarter for the fourth quarter, which would be the first time since the third quarter of 2020. Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup all opened mixed because of their earnings reports, but closed up on the day. The overall strength in response to investors buying helped close the S&P 500 on the week just shy of 4,000, as well as breaking the index above its 200-day moving average. Citigroup's profits fell 21% as the bank sets aside money for credit losses. Wells Fargo's profits were also cut by higher reserves and settlement costs. Bank of America beat earnings and revenue estimates as a result of a jump in interest income, which helped offset investment banking fees. The bank guided down on net interest income for the quarter, and CEO Monahan said the bank's baseline scenario is a mild recession. And those thoughts were also echoed by some of the other banks. Though it didn't affect the market, Janet Yellen warned Congress that the U.S. will hit its debt limit this next Thursday. She further warned that the Treasury Department will take measures to prevent the U.S. from defaulting, but didn't give a time limit on how far those measures would hold. But that's it for this week in the U.S. markets, with a Fed that's accommodating the current rally in stocks and bonds with an outlook that it may be able to pause soon. Consumer price index print that on the surface continues to disinflate, but shows no slowdown yet in service inflation. And the kickoff to the earnings season with a good reaction to financials Friday, but is estimated to see the first contraction in earnings since 2020. Up next, Jim Welsh at Macro Tides.
So I think the short answer is we definitely see things headed higher from here. In the near term, you do have China starting to reopen. You have China and the Chinese population starting to move, and inventories are extremely tight and they continue to draw. The SPR continues to be released and that all gets absorbed in the commercial markets. And we have not invested anything in the upstream energy business since the last time we spoke. I say we, I mean the market. You know, there's been no flows, no large institutional buying of energy stocks, and no major increases on the parts of any of these commodity companies to go out and drill more. So until you address any of those issues, you're not going to change the underlying fundamentals. And I think 2023 is going to shape up to be another very, very, very strong year for energy and for materials in general.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow@financialsense.com.
Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, one of the big questions as we enter 2023 is the bear market over? When will it end? And then the big question with Fed rate hikes, what about a recession? Well, let's explore those topics. Joining me from Macro Tides is Jim Welsh. And Jim, One of the big questions everybody keeps talking about, recession. Will we have one? Will we avoid one? Some people say first half, others are saying second half, and even some are saying, nah, not till 2024. Where do you come down on this idea?
I think we are going to have a recession, and that's based on some indicators that really have a very reliable, predictive value. I think most listeners are familiar with the yield curve. And whenever it inverts, historically, a recession has followed. The problem I have with that particular indicator is about the lead time, which historically has been an average of 19 months. So I prefer to look at the leading economic indicators, which is a composition of 10 separate economic data points. And historically, that has a lead time of about 10 months. It's declined 9 months in a row. And the magnitude of the decline is such, Jim, that there has never been a decline like we've seen without a recession occurring. And then the third point is bank lending standards. As we all know, the Fed's been raising the cost of money, but banks, when they start to get cautious about the economy, they raise lending standards, which then means they're starting to choke off the availability of money for the economy. And in the third quarter, lending standards jumped to a level that, again, historically has always been followed by a recession. So looking at those three indicators gives me a high degree of confidence that we are going to see a recession. And listeners can tune in and look at that chart, because I have a chart of each of the three things we just discussed. And it goes, most of those charts, I think, go back like 40, 50, 60 years. So they can judge for themselves in terms of the reliability and why I have confidence in making that call. At the same time, we have to acknowledge that consumers are still sitting on a chunk of savings. Granted, the bottom 25% of wage earners have probably burned through that, but you still have a pool of money that has to be worked through. Wage gains, although moderating, are still relatively high. Job growth continues to be pretty healthy. So my guess, Jim, is sometime around the middle of this year is when the economic stress is likely to build to a point where it's going to become more obvious that we're headed toward a recession. So my guess is somewhere around the middle of the year and progresses as the second quarter unfolds.
And of course, Jim, on the three points that you're making here, we're going to post your latest letter that has charts that kind of validate the points you're making. I want to bring up a second question, and that's the debate. As I mentioned, the debate boils down to first half, second half. The second debate is hard landing or a mild recession. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I would say Wall Street on balance, Jim, is really thinking that there won't be a recession overall. And there are obviously those who say, well, we might have a recession, but it's going to be short and sweet. And I think there's always a risk when once the economy starts to slow down, it doesn't take some exogenous event to happen that kind of gives the economy a greater shove. So that once we start to see the unemployment rate tick higher, and I believe it is going to be ticking higher as this year progresses, initially the increase is going to be very slow. But once it gets over 4%, consumers have a tendency then to become more cautious. They're 70% of GDP. So that to me is the wild card, Jim. I think, again, we're headed toward a recession. The depth of that recession, I don't know the depth of that. I think we just have to see events unfold. I think the key thing is to be prepared for the eventuality of a recession. And to me, those indicators suggest we should be.
And let's bring up something else that kind of strikes me, Jim. I'd love to get your viewpoint on this. Typically, you go into a recession, the government comes out with a stimulus program, some kind of fiscal spending, the Fed cuts interest rates. But Jim, ever since, even going back to Trump, but this administration is what passed $7.5 trillion of new spending.
Yes.
So if we go into recession, what do they do?
Well, I think the first thing we have to think about, Jim, is monetary policy has usually been the most quickest response in terms of a policy response. And I think this is where Wall Street is missing the point. The FOMC and Chair Powell have very specifically said they're planning to raise the funds rate a little bit more, but more importantly, they're going to hold the funds rate at a restrictive level for all of this year. Now, Wall Street is of the mind that the Fed may or may not get it up to 5%, but by the second half of this year, they're going to be cutting rates, which fits your lead into this is, yeah, we're going to have maybe a tough first half and then the second half is going to be terrific. And that all ties in with the idea that the Fed will be cutting rates in the second half of this year. Powell and company have specifically said they're trying to avoid a repeat of the mistakes that were made in the 1970s. In the 1970s, the Fed would just keep jacking rates higher. The economy would fall into a recession, significantly, which would force the Fed to reverse policy. They're trying to avoid that by getting the funds rate up towards 5% and then holding it there so that the cumulative impact of rate increases will gradually slow the economy. I think Powell made a pivot. You know, Wall Street's all year has been like in 2022, they kept jumping on the bandwagon of a pivot. I think his Brookings speech on November 30th did represent a pivot. What he effectively said is inflation, we anticipate to come down. We know that housing is going to keep it elevated for a while, but we're aware of that. But the most important thing is the labor market. And he made a number of specific points. For instance, he said, okay, population growth, we should have job growth of less than 100,000. Well, last month was 223,000. He wants to see the unemployment ratio to job openings decline. That's unchanged. So my point being is, to me, he clearly said the labor market holds the key and wages did moderate in December to 5.6. I think the Fed would much prefer, based on his history, to see it closer to 3%. So what I'm leading up to, Jim, is that the first signs of softening over the last 20 years, the Fed has typically responded pretty quickly. Wall Street is used to that. That's what they're factoring in, that as soon as the economy shows some wear and tear, they're going to start cutting rates. And I think what Chair Powell has said is, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to wait a while. And I think that's where the risk comes for the stock market in the second quarter. As we get more definitive signs that the economy is slowing, the Fed isn't going to be quick, if you will, to come to the rescue. As you know, Neel Kashkari is the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve. He's historically been one, if not the most dovish member of the FOMC. He's done a complete about face in the last 9 months. The December meeting shows a dot plot median of 5.1. Last week, he acknowledged he's at 5.4. But the comment he made in an interview with the New York Times, Jim, I think is really important and telling. He said, Wall Street is institutionally optimistic. They're going to lose in the game of chicken. So in his view, what's happening is Wall Street is doubting that the Fed has the resolve to follow through in keeping the funds rate high, even in the first signs of economic slowing. And that's why the 2 year is down at 415, the Fed funds at 437. And he's telling us that in his view, we're going to hold the line. And I think that is the lesson that Wall Street has not, acknowledged, because they're still running with the idea that the Fed is going to cave in as soon as the economy shows signs of weakening. And I believe the messaging from the Fed has been extraordinarily clear. They're not going to do that. And that will create a vulnerability in the market.
You know, something else I think that's going to impact the market, and I don't think Wall Street's really looking at this, Jim, if the economy begins to slow down, as we're seeing the LEIs now, especially with the big drop in the service sector ISM report last month, if you take a look at that, if the economy slows down, that's going to impact earnings. And, you know, they're still projecting rosy earnings for the S&P 500. I don't think it's a good reality given what we see coming ahead.
I agree with you, Jim. The one thing I would make as a comment, because I wrote about the ISM service number, because it was a very large drop from like over 55 to 49 and change. And that kind of a decline in a 1 month window of time is the kind of things we saw back in 2008 and obviously during the early days of the pandemic. So in looking at it, Jim, I realized that there was a huge storm from December 23rd on, that affected a large part of the U.S. Over 230 million people were affected either by absolute snow levels coming down. We all heard and saw stories about Buffalo, but temperatures were extraordinarily cold. So my point being is I think people overreacted to the ISM service number. It's going to rebound, I think, the next month we see it. But to your point, and as I said earlier, I think the economy is going to probably hold up okay in the first quarter, But as the full brunt of monetary policy comes to bear, I think we're going to see the economy slow more materially in the second quarter. And that's going to force Wall Street to recognize the point you're raising. They're going to have to cut earnings estimates for the back half of this year and probably early next year. And historically, when that gets done, the PE ratio on the overall earnings also contracts. So I think I'm on the same page with you, Jim. I think Wall Street has kind of developed a nice rosy scenario that is going to get challenged as we get deeper, especially into the second quarter of this year. And ultimately, I think that's going to have a negative impact on the stock market.
You know, something I also follow, Jim, is I follow Amazon. And last summer, Jeff Bezos said it's time to hunker down. The layoffs coming from Amazon, which I think is a good indicator of what's happening with the consumer, as being the largest online retailer. So when Bezos is saying it's time to hunker down, Jamie Dimon has a similar view. Very few people are paying attention to that. To me, it tells me a lot.
Yeah. The one thing about the job market is we've had these kind of very visible layoffs by Amazon, a number of other tech companies. In total, though, they do represent a really small percentage of the total labor force. And after struggling to find able workers, I think a lot of employers are going to be reluctant to let them go at the first sign of real softening. So historically, what we see is they get rid of temporary workers, which has already begun. They cut back on overtime hours, which has already begun. The average work week starts to shrink. So in other words, they're addressing labor costs, but they're doing it before they have to actually lay somebody off. And that, my point being is that as we get further into this year, you kind of hit a critical mass point where all of a sudden enough weakness shows up, and then you start to see more companies across a wider select group of industries begin to do layoffs. And that gets down to, again, are we going to have a shallow recession or a deeper recession? And that is going to be dependent on just how much, the unemployment rate accelerates. One of the charts I have in that deck shows over the last 50, 60 years, historically, the biggest increase in the unemployment rate doesn't happen until you're well into the recession. So again, that just emphasizes the labor market's a lagging indicator. It's going to take a while, but once the domino starts going, it picks up steam. And I think that's what we're going to see, particularly in the second half of this year and going into next year.
Yeah, one of the things I think that has surprised many is that the unemployment rate has remained as strong as it has. Jim, I live in an area where there's a brand new Amazon Fresh store that has been completed and vacant for almost a year because they can't get enough workers to do it. There was another new restaurant that just opened up, and they're only opening up for breakfast and lunch because they don't have enough workers for dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this labor shortage is a chronic problem. I mean, I've written about this extensively over the last 6 months, because if you look at the labor participation rate, it peaked back in 2001 and has been in a downtrend ever since. The pandemic accelerated the problem because a lot of older people close to retirement, said, hey, I'm done. I'm out of here. We also have people who are dealing with some measure of COVID. The estimate is about 500,000 people aren't working because they're sick at any given time. So that problem of getting enough bodies, again, it's a governor, if you will, on economic activity. Amazon would love to open that store. The restaurants would love to have people sitting at tables eating. If they can't find the bodies, they can't accomplish that. So that is a structural problem that I think is going to take time to wear out. But the point is, though, as long as that persists, that puts a floor on wages. I think 25 different states around the country increased their minimum wage January 1st. 10 years ago, about 10% of all workers were getting paid above the minimum wage. It's now over 30%. So this structural problem of finding labor will continue to lift wages. And that also, I think, makes it tougher for inflation after this initial unwind that we're seeing, and it's going to continue in the first quarter of this year. But getting it down closer to what the Fed wants, the labor market is going to be a headwind for the Fed accomplishing that.
I want to go to a final topic, and that's inflation. Typically, when you go into recession, companies slash prices, lay off workers. They're trying to move merchandise. They don't want to sit on inventory. What about inflation? Because I see some larger macro events that are going to keep inflation, maybe, I don't know, as high as it got last year, but certainly I think it's going to be difficult for the Fed to get down to a 2% inflation rate. Where do you stand on that?
I agree. I mean, I think the Fed will get the inflation down to the 3 to 3.5% range. But I think what you're alluding to is, we just talked about the labor market tightness, keeping wages more elevated than they otherwise would. Over the last decade, there's been a big drop off in the amount of investment in oil and gas. So that suggests that energy prices, which historically declined after a period of high prices because oil companies went out and found a lot more oil and gas, that's not happening. And then globalization is another factor which really depressed prices for much of the last 20 years. Over the last 5-6 years, that's obviously been unwinding. So you're 100% right, Jim. There are structural issues that in the past were a tailwind for keeping inflation low. Now all of them are kind of conspiring to kind of lift inflation and sustain it at a higher level. So the ultimate question is going to be, is if we're right, inflation does drop towards 3-3.5%, will the Fed, you know, decide that, okay, that's good enough? I'd say right now, given what Powell and others are saying, they're very sincere in the belief that, as he has said numerous times, stable prices are the bedrock of the economy. Powell has said a number of times that those who are hurt most are those on the lower income bracket. And they really believe, and I think this is why Kashkari has kind of joined Powell in terms of a similar line of thinking, that if they can get inflation down to the targets, even if it takes a couple of years, that in the long run, the lower income folks are going to be benefited by that significantly. And I think that's why we've seen somebody like Kashkari, who in the past has always been a dove, fought about against raising rates and so forth. He's joined forces with Powell because I think ultimately they believe having inflation down at a low level is what's going to work best for everybody, even if it means some short-term pain. And one other comment, if I can make, Jim, because I think it's really pertinent. This week, Powell was giving a speech, and he talked about the Fed's independence and how important it was. And he basically said, we're going to be raising rates, the economy's going to slow, and we're going to be getting blowback politically. And that basically it was imperative that the Fed ignore that political pressure so that they can achieve their goal of bringing inflation down. So he's almost preparing, if you will, the Fed for the political backlash we're going to see if unemployment starts to tick up, particularly early next year, because next year is another election year. So again, all that does is remind me or reinforce my belief that the Fed's resolve is about as strong as it could be. I suspect it's going to remain pretty strong, even in the face of some negative unemployment news and negative news on the economy.
Final question. Given this, that you and I both expect we're going to head into a recession, we both expect that earnings are going to drop. I would suspect, given that, you're somewhat cautious at this point.
Yeah, I think near term, Jim, the economy is going to be okay. The Atlanta Fed GDP now for the fourth quarter, their number is 4.1%. I think that probably overstates the actual, you know, growth that we saw in the fourth quarter. Maybe it's more like 2.5. But I think the earnings that are going to come out are going to be okay for most companies, in the sense that their costs have been coming down in terms of energy costs. Wage growth is a little bit of an issue, obviously. But on balance, I think earnings are going to be okay in the fourth quarter. And Wall Street wants to believe in this idea that, hey, we're going to get a soft landing. Inflation is going to miraculously come down. The Fed won't have to keep raising rates. They're going to cut rates. And so I think that can sustain the market through much of the first quarter. It's the second quarter that I think is problematic. One of the other charts that is in the deck that you're going to put on your site is a chart of the S&P 500. And it's been very instructive to look at the rally that happened after COVID from the March 2020 low. The S&P bottomed around 2,200. It rallied to a little over 4,800. And I use Fibonacci retracement numbers, and I'm sure that's going to glaze a lot of people's eyes over. But it basically says, okay, there's a pattern that exists, and at different percentages of a pullback that the market seeks out. So the 382 retracement was about 3,800. I expected that to happen. It got hit in May and June. I also expected this 50% retracement at 3505 to get hit. That got hit in October. The 618 retracement of the that big move, Jim, is around 3,200. So if everything unfolds as you and I have been discussing, that the economy enters a recession as we get past mid-year and earnings get cut, I think the S&P has the potential to drop towards 3,200. And at that point in time, I think that will represent a good buying opportunity. Got to take it one step at a time, but that's the bigger picture as I see it at this point.
Well, if you take where we are right now and we get down to 3,200, that would be a 20% drop. So that would be painful. Jim, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at Macro Tides, once again, we're going to post this newsletter on the topics we've been discussing here. How could they do so?
Well, they should go to your website and look at the charts that are going to be there, Jim, because I give them instructions at the beginning of that piece that's going to be posted. I have a special report called The Coming Secular Bear Market, and I'm happy to also send the most recent, in this case, January Macro Tides, and then I do a weekly technical review. So if people send me an email, jimwelshmacro@gmail.com, I'm happy to send that information out. My website is macrotides.com, so they can check some things out there. But if you want quick response to get the information I just alluded to, go to your website, check out the charts that are going to be posted there, and they'll have that information to reach out and get the information I've offered.
Well, listen, Jim, Happy New Year. As always, thanks for joining us on the program. Hope to talk to you again.
Sounds good, Jim. Thanks very much. Always enjoy our conversations.
Well, there's a new book that was released late last year. It's titled, Does Putin Have to Die? The Story of How Russia Becomes a Democracy After Losing to Ukraine. And it's a fascinating book written by Ilya Ponomarev and Greg Stebbins.
So Ilya Ponomarev was a member of the Russian parliament. He was in 2014 the only member of the Russian parliament to vote against the annexation of Crimea. And that is a very, very important part of the story and a very important part of the genesis of this book, Does Putin Have to Die? He voted against the annexation of Crimea. And look, in that system, which is autocratic, when you oppose the leader, there can be some serious consequences. So as his reward for voting against Putin on Crimea and being the only one to vote against him, Ilya was put on the kill list and remains there to this day. He'll jokingly say, you know, I keep a machine gun by my door. That is not hyperbole. That is true. When you're talking with him, many of his stories involve people that at the end of the story is he's dead now. And the implication is he's dead now for being a political opponent of Putin. So this is very serious stuff. And it was a very courageous thing that he did when he opposed the annexation of Crimea. And Ilya said at the time, and very publicly, you can go watch him on the BBC or US news channels. He said at the time, if this annexation happens, it will lead to a full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And he also said, if Russia ever invades Ukraine, I will fight on the side of Ukraine. This was part of his immediate reaction and his justification for opposing the annexation of Crimea. He was, shortly after the annexation, so back in 2014, forced out of the country. So he has not been back to Russia since 2014. When you talk about Russian opposition, there's really four main figures. There's Ilya, there's Mikhail Khodorkovsky, there's Garry Kasparov, the chess master, and of course there's Navalny, who's in prison. Those are really, when you talk about Russian opposition, the four main players. And they're forming a new government. They're writing a new constitution, which when they take power will go to the people, so that at the time where Putin is gone, they know they do have a choice and that this is an option.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, here we are at the beginning of the year. The Fed is widely expected to be raising interest rates, getting the Fed funds rate over 5%. There's talk about a recession. They're talking about pause or pivot. Let's find out what happens. Joining us on the program is Danielle DiMartino Booth. And Danielle, you know, as I was looking at the consensus opinions, some say we hit a recession in the first half. Some say it's in the second half. You got people like Bloomberg that say 100% probability by Q4. And then you have the government bond dealers, 65% of them, see a recession this year. What's your view, given what you see?
Well, you know, we had the final of three, if you will, National Federation of Independent Businesses come in, and their confidence was much lower than what had been expected. This adds on to what we've seen coming out of the manufacturing sector, which is recessionary, what we've seen coming out of the service sector, which is 80% of the economy, even more recessionary in terms of the ISM report, especially the 10-point decline in new orders. So we're talking about future demand, and CEOs as well, and CFOs for that matter. So if you add all of the contingencies up, the service sector, the small business sector, the manufacturing, the factory sector, and the people running companies, they all foresee recession. So I'm not quite sure why there's a debate on Wall Street that is designed to fight these readings, to deny and defy them. It makes no sense to me, because we're being told that we are in recession by the people who make decisions about the future, and yet there's this big debate on Wall Street. Something does not square.
Yeah, it does make sense to me. The other issue is Wall Street keeps talking about a pivot. They want that liquidity back into the market. What are the chances the Fed does pivot? Or, Danielle, is there a possibility that perhaps with inflation remaining somewhat sticky, they basically say, well, we're just going to go on pause. We're not going to do anything. In other words, they're not going to dramatically start cutting rates, which is what Wall Street is hoping for.
Well, and I think that it was interesting on Friday when the market just went haywire, tacking on whatever it was, 700 points. And there were four Fed speakers out, and they all said the same thing, which was slightly different than we're going to get the terminal rate up to 5.5%, whatever it is that they all say. That wasn't the new news in the cohesiveness of the remarks. Rather, it was that they're going to get interest rates up and keep them up throughout 2023. And they all said it. So that, on top of Powell's first public remarks in some time since press conference in December, with Powell saying, you know, fighting inflation can be a fairly unpopular thing to do, but this isn't a popularity contest. I just tweeted that out. Powell says it's not a popularity contest. So he's prepared to take the heat to stay the course. And I really think that markets are disregarding this message and are setting themselves up for yet another disappointment.
Yeah, because that was the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, basically saying, I know what I'm doing is unpopular on both sides of the aisle, but this is something I have to do. I want to talk about something. We have monetary policy, which is becoming restrictive, and you have fiscal policy. I mean, Danielle, they just passed another $1.7 trillion stimulus bill. How much of that is keeping this economy afloat when you think of all the stimulus bills that have come out in the last 2 years under Biden and before that under Trump?
Well, so here I'm going to play contrarian. The new stimulus package is what we were accustomed to and why we would not have been talking about it prior to the pandemic stimulus bills. It was just a bunch of pork. They couldn't even get through in the lame duck session with the Democrats running both the House and the Senate. They couldn't get through the big ask, which was, we want the child tax credit in cash. So what you get from this $1.7 trillion bill is a whole lot of nothing, because there's no money being directly deposited into U.S. household accounts. If you don't get that, you don't generate inflation. You get pork belly spending, inefficient forms of spending, you know, the proverbial bridge to nowhere. That's the kind of spending bill that was passed. What ignited inflation, that really changed the discussion about fiscal stimulus, is here's $1.9 trillion, and most of it's going to get directly deposited into bank accounts. Now, the reason that we've seen outsized inflation, and I, you know, I had a few friends of mine reach out to me on the street and say, wow, your 2023 outlook pointed out something that wasn't even on our radar screen. So I don't know if you're driving down the road listening to Bloomberg Radio, getrefunds.com. These are not refunds, IRS refunds for individuals. This is probably the biggest slush fund ever given to high-income earners in U.S. history. In 2022, $165 billion of refunds were mailed to companies that took advantage of a loophole that Biden signed into the final stimulus bill that had the stimulus check attached to it that said, if you can show that for even 5 minutes, your company was disrupted by COVID in the full year 2021, then you can claw back up to $26,000 per employee of payroll taxes. I mean, I'll give you the most extreme example I've heard, Jim. This is what I've heard. Company got bought out by private equity. They sold 70% of the family firm, and this was in November. And over the next 6 months, they were anticipating, because the IRS had told them that it would come over a six-month period. So over the next 6 months through May of 2023, they were going to be receiving a seven-figure income tax refund.
Wow.
So we're wondering, why are there children in first class? There are children flying first class because every small business owner, medium-sized business owner, private company clawed back $26,000 per employee. Auto dealer that I know of with 100 employees got back a $2.2 million business income tax refund. So a lot of money was stealthily pumped into the U.S. economy in the last year that's had most on Wall Street saying, look, it's a baton handoff from goods spending to services spending. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's just spending your refund money. That's it.
So let me ask another question. The Fed is raising interest rates. I'm looking at a Treasury screen. We've got three-month T-bills, or let me see here. Let me go to another screen. So I'm looking at three-month Treasuries at 4.7, six-month Treasuries at 4.8. What is this going to do to interest expense as we approach $32 trillion in debt? It's hard to believe, Daniel, back in 2019, what were we at, $20 trillion? Here we are 3-4 years later, we're at $32 trillion almost.
It really is remarkable. And I'm going to go back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. And that is kind of the message in Fed speak that's being roundly ignored. So it's easy enough because some people, they haven't made note of the fact that the U.S. Treasury extended its maturity, that the maturity of the Treasury is outstanding in the last few years. I'm not saying they've raised 50-year paper or a century bond, but they have indeed extended maturities out. And that's why what you're talking about has yet to bite. But if the Fed holds interest rates, just holds them, let's say they get the Fed funds rate up to 5% and keep it there. By the end of this year, especially given just the absolute drama we've seen in the GOP-led House of Representatives, if they just accomplish that, keeping interest rates high by the end of 2023, we will have serious fiscal pressure because extended out the maturities they may have, that does not mean that they're not going to have to refinance between now and next New Year's.
So given the fact that the deficits are huge, not only that, you've got a lot of boomers like myself heading into retirement, they're receiving Social Security, they're receiving Medicare. So entitlements are taking a larger portion of the budget. And then you go forward another year from now where this debt's going to have to start being refinanced at higher interest rates. What are the chances we get into a fiscal crisis?
Well, that's why I was saying, that's why I was bringing this drama that we saw around 15 votes to get the Speaker of the House. I don't think, given what we have learned through this experience, that the debt limit that's supposed to come this fall, that debate is going to be benign. I think it's going to be contentious, given the massive drama that we've just seen play out by individuals who are holding out for a more fiscally responsible U.S. government. So I don't even anticipate it being, in fact, if you look at what's being priced into the market right now, bond market investors are already pricing differently, very short-term treasury bills and what have you, around the time that the government is expected to run out of money, recognizing that the extremists, if you will, those on the farthest right end of the spectrum, want a pound of flesh and want for the U.S. debt to be cut. And I saw a mainstream economist come out today saying the U.S. is at risk of being downgraded, the sovereign risk. Well, that last happened in 2011. And boy, it was not pretty. It was ugly.
You know, another issue that is out there, too, is you've got countries like Russia, China, you've got OPEC that are moving away the pricing of oil in dollars, and you've got BRIC countries in wanting to join the BRICS in this new currency, whatever they're going to deal with, whether it's going to be gold, rubles, or it's going to be Chinese yuan. What about that and the inflationary impact if more and more commodities globally are not going to be priced in dollars anymore?
Well, we've had this discussion multiple times over the past few years. And my contrarian view is that the theoretical end game here, which would be China taking over reserve currency status, it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And it's because China doesn't want it. It's massive responsibilities. It's a massive cost as well. But for the moment, at least, the more people talk about the dollar not being used, the more it's used. So there's a certain irony and circularity there. And the weaker the global economy, the more there's going to be a fallback onto the US dollar. And again, it's not because China doesn't want power. It's that China knows that it's a really expensive form of power and they don't want it.
And not to mention the most widely liquid security market in the world is the US. And you take a look at China, they just don't have the depth of the security markets.
Of course not. No. I mean, who's to trust them? Every few years, they completely change the rules.
So given what you see right now, what do you think are the probabilities? What are they pricing in? Maybe a quarter point in February, maybe another one in April. What's your perspective? How high do you think they go? Do they scale it down to a quarter point and keep raising till they get to that 5.5, whatever that terminal rate is? Where do you think they'll go?
I think they do. You know, we've seen used car prices fall by 15% year over year. That's the most on record. And even though it's a very small input into the consumer price index, used cars were nonetheless the largest driver of inflation on the way up. So they will also be the largest driver of disinflation on the way down. We've seen rents come down and come down hard. We're seeing home prices come down. So I think the Fed knows that it's dealing with a disinflationary environment, which is also being reflected in, I'll bring the small businesses back up. They're saying that even though they need to maintain higher prices, fewer and fewer every month are saying they're able to. Pricing power goes away when fiscal stimulus goes away. And you know, people have run up their credit cards. They don't have very much to spend anymore. They've run down their savings. So disinflation is going to be powerful. And I think that we'll see that in CPI reports. I think we could possibly see a negative year-over-year CPI print in 2023. It's not my base case, but I think it's highly possible. But the question that you're asking gets to a different matter. And that's that, so what if they reduce the pace of interest rate increases to 25 basis points on February the 1st, come the March meeting, come the June meeting? They're still shrinking their balance sheet. And that, I think, is even if they completely continue to ignore MBA prepayments, mortgage-backed security prepayments tanking, and therefore they're only getting off $65 billion a month or so. It's really begun to hurt. No offense here, but you've been around for a little while, Jim. You've seen a few cycles. Knowing that in your lifetime, you've never seen M2 money growth at zero, ever. And yet that's what we saw on November the 30th. And you know, we're seeing a shorter term gauges of money growth, negative year over year. Quantitative tightening, something, by the way, that Jay Powell refuses to talk about. It's like the elephant in the room. Quantitative tightening is having a very real effect as the European Central Bank prepares itself to embark on a much smaller level of quantitative tightening, but marginally increasing the global effect at the same time. So to your question about the size of Fed interest rate hikes, it's a non-issue. Who cares if it goes to 25 basis points, 25 basis points, and 25 basis points, if the equivalent of these rate hikes is flowing into financial market instability on a monthly basis?
So given this, you know, for the first time, Danielle, at least in probably the last 10, 12 years, if you are a conservative investor, we now have credit instruments that are offering somewhat of a yield versus zero. In fact, Howard Marks at Oaktree just penned a piece called Sea Change, and he talked about this is probably the third pivot in his investment career where credits are at least being somewhat priced decently. In other words, credit investors have at least somewhat of a return now.
You know, it's interesting you raise this point because we have told our children over the holidays who are 15, 17, and 18. And so they're, gee, I really want to start investing. I'm like, A, you're a little bit late to the game, but they're hearing their friends, you know, meme stocks and Bitcoin and what have you. I said, instead, we're going to go do something more fundamental. The First Internet Bank of Indiana, where they happen to attend boarding school, but the First Internet Bank of Indiana is paying 4.86% on your money. Why don't we instead back up the truck and teach you something that generations of children we've not been able to teach? Why don't we just teach you the basics of compound interest? Jim, you see where I'm coming from.
Oh, yes. What a novel concept.
What a novel concept.
Yeah, I mean, we're heavily invested in treasuries right now. And, you know, I haven't been this happy since probably 2000 when we got out of the market and we went to foreign credits, which were 4.5% in sovereign debt. Danielle, we haven't seen anything like this. And that's why when I saw Howard Marks's piece about a third pivot in his career, I think we're at such a point.
I would agree. I would agree that the rules of engagement have changed. And the fact that, especially as a baby boomer right now, looking not to pare back the number of hours you're working, but actually leave the workforce. And now you can make money on your cash so you can sleep at night. To me, this is a marked shift in portfolio in asset allocation, one we haven't seen in a very long time. And the implications for the stock market or junk bonds or whatever grandma and grandpa have jumped into in order to try and get yield in a yieldless world. The implications are deep.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Danielle, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the publications that you put out at Quill, how could they do so?
Well, I invite them to come to quillintelligence.com, and that's certainly where they can learn more. And we welcome them. We put out the least biased, best quality research, independent research in the world, in my very humble opinion, obviously. And if they don't follow me on Twitter, you know, they should. It's a lot of fun there. It's a learning experience every day at DiMartino Booth.
Well, ever since 2020, we've been discussing how there is very likely going to be higher inflation coming down the pike. And that was a warning that we were making not only on our Big Picture segment of Financial Sense News Hour, but including with a number of different guests, most notably Russell Napier, who is a longtime disinflation or deflationist ever since the 80s up until just recently, and then made a big U-turn in his thinking, warning about coming inflation, not just for the year or two ahead, but for the remainder of this decade. And that was a big U-turn that he had made around 2020. We've spoken with him and a number of other guests on our podcast about the long-term outlook for higher than average inflation. Today, we're going to look at the macro environment, how it is changing dramatically this decade from hyperglobalization to deglobalization, if we want to call it that, with rising energy prices, a weakening dollar, and commodity shortages that will impact investing in this decade.
Well, let's talk about inflation first, Chris, because this is one of the issues that the Fed misjudged. And from the Fed's perspective, I mean, they went QE after the financial crisis. They went QE after the bursting of the tech bubble. And Chris, we never got the high inflation that we're seeing now. So they thought, well, you know, they'll start raising interest rates and they won't have to do much. That everything is, they thought it was more supply chain oriented, and some of it is, but they weren't judging what we were seeing on the physical front, which was having a major impact. And we're going to get into that in just a minute. But let's talk about deglobalization, because that's a big trend. We've done interviews multiple times with Peter Zion on his book. And so one of the things that came up with the pandemic is we found out there were shortages because everything's made in China, manufactured goods, even to pharmaceuticals. And that was one of the issues that happened during the pandemic is people had a hard time getting everything from drugs to computer chips. So as we now move towards deglobalization, this era that we went in over the last two decades where we outsourced everything to in manufacturing to China, it helped to bring down the cost of manufactured goods. That era is going away. So if we start bringing factories back here, it's going to be more localized, or reshoring is another word that we use for it. It's going to be more expensive. It's going to be more expensive to make things here versus China. So that is going to have an inflationary impact. But the biggest issue, that the reason we're seeing inflation, is fiscal policy. You have to understand that under Trump, we were running trillion-dollar deficits. Then COVID came, and I think there was like $3 trillion of stimulus that was passed, from the helicopter drops, then where people were actually getting checks put in their bank account. And Chris, remember that also when you were in lockdowns, you were staying at home, you weren't going anywhere, nothing was open. So people were building up their savings. There was nowhere to go, no place to spend. Then the Biden administration comes in, we're coming out of the pandemic, the economy's opening up, and it's starting to gain momentum, economic momentum. And then we come in with a $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, which put more money into the economy, which created more demand for goods and more demand for services, and the classic definition of inflation, too much money chasing too few goods. And we still have it. We just passed another $1.7 trillion of new spending at the end of the year. So Biden is pushing $7.5 trillion, and it's one of the reasons that the bond market's having difficulty, and we'll get to that in a minute, because the Treasury is having to raise massive amounts of money as the deficit approaches $32 trillion and is now growing at trillions of dollars a year. So fiscal policy is highly inflationary. Monetary policy is still inflationary in terms of we have real negative interest rates. So this is going to be something that I think eventually you're going to see the Fed get into financial repression and yield curve control, because we're going to have a real problem down the road when you see these deficits get so big, the debt gets so big, and then all of a sudden interest rates are getting high. The Treasury and the U.S. government cannot afford 6.5% interest rates. So you're going to see yield curve control in financial repression. That's going to be inflationary. Then the other thing, and probably one of the bigger things when it comes to energy and commodities, is banana green and ESG policies, which are leading to higher energy prices. Chris, I don't know if you got your bill, but you know our natural gas bill is going to be going up over 20%. California has probably the highest gasoline prices in the country, but also the highest utility rates as we shut down our nuclear plants, as we shut down our nat gas plants, our coal plants, and we go to wind and solar, which are intermittent and more expensive. So that is going to be driving higher energy prices. And then let's not also forget regulation, which drives up prices. So as we've talked about in the past, historically, whenever you've reached over an 8% inflation rate, it usually takes a decade or more before normalizing. So one of the big issues you are going to be dealing as an investor this decade is an inflationary decade. Now, there's talk that inflation rates will come down by midsummer. Maybe we're in the 3 to 4% range. But Chris, I don't see inflation rates going to 2%. And to get down to 2%, the Fed would literally have to put the economy into a Great Depression. It's bad enough that we're heading into a recession. How bad it will depend on basically how bad it gets with interest rates. So I just don't see that happening. And so that's why I think we're going to have very similar to what we saw happen in the late 60s to the early 80s. We'll have a brief period where inflation will heat up. The Fed will tighten interest rates, put us into a recession, bring the rate of inflation down, and then once again start up QE or financial repression, and it'll be a series of waves of inflation that we're going to deal with throughout this decade.
Yeah, and yesterday we should point out that the December CPI report came out at 6.5%, so it shows that inflation does continue to cool from the 9.1% peak that we got to last year. Now, if you look at Trueflation's real-time dashboard, which tracks millions of different items across the U.S., we've spoken with their founder and CEO on our weekday podcast, FS Insider, about this, but if you check Trueflation.com, it shows that we're currently at around 5.5%. percent. So that would be for the month of January. So that's an important indicator that you can watch in real time to get a good leading view or real-time view of what to expect for the official CPI report that comes out weeks after the fact. But I think the point is we are seeing disinflation right now from the high peaks that we saw. But on a longer-term basis, we should expect, given some of the items that you mentioned already, higher than average inflation that we saw in the decade prior, particularly from 2009 to 2020, given the fact that that was abnormally low inflation. That's not the normal. The normal is going to be probably more around that 3 to 4%. So we will see deviations from that in the short term. We are, again, seeing disinflation now currently underway. But don't expect this trend to continue indefinitely all the way back down to 1% to 2% like we saw in the prior decade.
Yeah. So as we enter an inflationary decade, there's a tremendous amount of implications for investing, whether you're in stocks or in bonds. We'll get to that later on.
Now, Jim, let's talk about the dollar and how this fits into the multipolar, as some people discuss it, or even bipolar world that we're moving into. There's been a lot of talk about that. We've had a number of interesting guests on the show to explain kind of how this fits into the investment environment and what you need to consider when it comes to inflation, investment implications. So what's your view on how the dollar fits into this?
Well, one of the problems that many of these countries had, including Russia and China, the U.S. has used the dollar as a world's currency as a diplomatic weapon for sanctions. So when Russia invaded Ukraine, we, you know, basically threw them out of the SWIFT system. We confiscated assets. I mean, we're in San Diego and there's a $350 million Russian mega yacht here, one of the oligarchs that we seized. So we've been using this dollar as a weapon to deny people access to the system. Well, a lot of these countries are saying, wait a minute, I don't want to be in a position where all of a sudden I'm locked out of the financial system. So you're seeing a movement within the BRIC countries, which is Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and what I call BRIC Plus. A lot of commodity producers, whether it's in Africa or in South America, are moving away from the dollar and saying, we don't want to be in a position where we're locked out of the system. And remember, when the Fed raises interest rates, think of what it did to the dollar and how that impacts other economies. So as the dollar has risen with these higher interest rates and commodity prices have risen, it's a double whammy for a lot of these foreign countries because they have to import oil and pay for that oil in dollars. Well, if oil is going up and your currency is even dropping further, it's a double whammy. You're paying even higher prices, just like they are in natural gas and for oil in Europe. So a lot of these countries are moving away. You're seeing a movement now with China and Russia, with the Gulf states, where they're moving away from the petrodollar. So they're some of the countries, Russia is going to be taking payment for oil and gold. Payment for oil and rubles, same thing dealing with oil with China, with the yuan. So just as we deglobalize and we get into regional trade blocks, you're going to see that with regional currencies. They're working on a gold-backed currency in Asia. I don't know if that will be the yuan or some other currency that they name it, but we're moving out of the petrodollar. And this deals with China's One Belt, One Road, where China essentially is acting as banker to the rest of the world. And so as they loan money to countries like Argentina, well, China doesn't want to get Argentine pesos. What they're getting paid with is commodities. So you're basically seeing the commodity markets encumbered by China through its lending practices to these countries. So China is going to be a dominant force when it comes to commodities. They're one of the largest, they have some of the largest stockpiles of copper and other key minerals, especially rare earths, that are needed in our technological society. And even our green society requires a lot of these key minerals that China dominates in. The other thing that we have is, as this happens, as we move away, as many countries, whether it's OPEC, whether it's the BRIC countries or BRIC Plus, move away from the dollar, in a sense, it will lose its reserve status. And why that's important is someday if the U.S. has to import commodities because basically ESG and banana green policies are shutting down mining to drilling for oil, we have to start importing those commodities, whether it's cobalt, lithium, copper, or any other commodity, and we can no longer pay for them with dollars, that's going to be inflationary. So eventually, Chris, with the deficits growing at trillions of dollars, you know, in the next 3 or 4 years, we could be facing $40 trillion in debt. You can just imagine the interest on that. Eventually, one way to get rid of that debt is to devalue the dollar, very much like what Roosevelt did to get rid of deflation in the 30s. He devalued the dollar against gold. And the reason it won't work against other currencies, if we devalue against the yen or we devalue against the euro, well, they just respond and they devalue their currency. So it's a beggar thy neighbor policy. So more likely, the real way to devalue the dollar will be to devalue the dollar against gold. It's one way to get rid of the debt problems that the U.S. is facing mid-decade.
Yeah, Jim, I want to touch upon a point that you just raised, which I think is really interesting. And this was something that we just recently discussed with Gary Schilling. That's going to play next week on FS Insider. But he pointed out that China's Belt and Road Initiative, that they had made around $1 trillion worth of loans to all of these various emerging markets, like you said, BRIC countries, BRIC plus, as you refer to it. And many of those loans are now coming due. And these are, in many cases, distressed nations who are not able to make those payments. And so what China is saying is, instead of saying, okay, well, pay us back or we'll extend these loans, they're saying, just ship us your commodities instead. So this leads into the third part of the conversation, which is, you know, the commodity super cycle or a longer term bull market in commodities. So tell us, you know, how this fits into your outlook for commodities more long-term this decade.
Well, let's begin with oil, because I wrote an article from Oil Glut to Oil Crisis. I think it was March or April of 2020. And Chris, I was basing that on what I was seeing in terms of investment, because oil companies produce oil. The oil goes out the front door. They need to invest to discover more oil to replace what it is they're producing. And with oil dropping from the $100 level, we got down to, in the 40s, 60 level, companies stopped investing. A lot of the shale companies weren't making money. Wall Street got fed up with the shale companies because they never made any money. So they even stopped lending them. And then the policy coming out of Wall Street is, look, we're not going to give you any more money to do this if all you do is produce oil and you don't make any money. We want to see payback and share buybacks, dividend increases, but the last thing we want you to do is invest for more capacity, and that stopped. So oil investment in itself has dropped in half, and it's still low because you look at it today. The government was hassling these oil companies a little over a year ago. They were telling them to divest themselves of their oil assets, and then all of a sudden we get higher oil prices, and then they flip. So if you're an oil company with banana green and ESG policies, what is the incentive to invest for new production? So companies are being very tight-fisted with their budget. They're returning cash to shareholders in the forms of dividends. They're buying back stock. Exxon's going to buy $50 billion of their stock back. So a lot of these shortages have led to what we see today. There's a shortage of copper, shortage of silver, shortage of oil, all the key commodities, because just like the ESG banana green policies have gone against the oil companies, the same thing with money. There was a mine in Minnesota which was not allowed to go into production. There was a cobalt discovery or lithium discovery in Maine that was shut down. There's all these mines that they've been trying to get into production. There's just no way, whether you're shutting down pipelines, which makes it more expensive to transport oil, or you're denying companies the right to drill and not giving them the leases. I mean, what good is it if you bid on the lease if you don't get the permit? So all of this, and this is not just occurring here, you're seeing it in many parts of the world where these policies are being implemented. So a lot of this is led to what we're seeing today, low inventories, and eventually, Chris, you're going to see food shortages. Look what the government of the Netherlands is doing to farmers. They're shutting down farms because they don't want farmers using natural gas-based fertilizers. So look for food shortages and famine, which Peter Zion has a big, big chapter in his new book on the coming famines that we're going to see that's going to really hit countries like in Latin America and Africa, unfortunately. So this lack of investing in mining and energy, and it's basically when you have, I mean, let's put it this way. Let's say you make a discovery, whether it's a mine or you want to put in a pipeline. Good luck, because the first thing you're going to see is NGOs, or you're going to face environmental lawsuits. Chris, you can probably remember here in San Diego, we tried to build a freeway that went from the inland valley to the coast, and it was wrapped up in environmental lawsuits for over 10 years. First, it was the gnatcatcher, then it was the coastal sagebrush, and I don't know, some kind of ant or something, but it took 10 years of lawsuits to finally win them in court where they had the ability to push through on that freeway system that connected the inland valley to the coast. So this is what happens anytime you want to do anything environmentally to deal with natural resources or even putting things like a freeway or a pipeline or heck, even housing. So a lot of this regulation is preventing what we need to do. So if we're going to deglobalize, meaning we're going to bring factories back here, well, factories need raw materials and energy to run and make things. And if we're not going to do that, then we're going to have to import those commodities here. It's like Chevron isn't allowed to drill in areas with new leases, but they're allowed to go drill in Venezuela, which has dirtier oil. So a lot of this stuff, and this was brought up in a recent interview we're going to play on Insider with Alex Epstein on fossil future that talks about these difficulties that mining or energy companies are dealing with.
Yeah, that was a fantastic interview. So definitely look forward to hearing some of the feedback on that and the number of the points that he makes. But again, that's why we've called them banana greens. Banana standing for build absolutely nothing anywhere near anybody, unless it's out in the middle of the desert somewhere where you may not see it. Or if it's in China, for example, with all the various mines and processing facilities, you know, it's out of sight, out of mind. So there's a lot of, perhaps we can call it cognitive dissonance that's taking place here. But I think people are starting to understand these things a little bit more. And as Adam Rosenzweig noted on our podcast this week, you know, we have seen drilling activity really underpace oil prices. So going back to your point about shortages, particularly in energy, you know, we're not seeing rig counts come up to the level that is justified by current prices. And that's because of policy pressures. You know, companies are just not willing to put in those necessary investments if they think that their assets are going to get stranded or if they're going to get caught up with litigation in the courts. So, you know, I mean, there's over 100 different policy decisions that have been made across the board to make it much harder to drill for oil and gas. And that's something that you can look at from that's been compiled by Tom Pyle, the Institute for Energy Research.
Chris, we're seeing the result of this in terms of energy shortages, power outs. So what we're doing, if you think of our modern world today, we have more devices that we have to charge. You got to charge your iPad. You got to charge your iPhone. You got to charge your iWatch, your laptop, your computers. Then you add to that, we start going to EVs, you're going to be charging your car. So there's going to be greater demand for electricity. At the same time, we're destabilizing the grid by getting rid of coal, which is reliable, natural gas, which is reliable, nuclear, which is reliable, and replacing it with wind and solar, which is more expensive and intermittent. So just like last summer in California, we were told you don't charge your EV during the day from 3 to 8 at night, and we had power outages. I mean, you know, my house is solar powered, but it's still tied to the grid. So what I'm going to have to do is now invest in solar batteries so that when we do have these power outs, everything still runs. So it's making it more expensive. I'm fortunate enough that I, you know, my house is solar powered and I can afford to get batteries. And it was interesting because the last power out, I was sitting outside at night and the power went out. And a neighbor just across the street, his lights were on. He has solar, but he has solar batteries. So this is where we're going. It's going to get more expensive. We just got notice that our nat gas bill is going up over 20%. And I imagine if you're on the East Coast, it's probably going up more. So green policies are going to create shortages and drive up prices.
So, Jim, let's tie some of these things up into how to invest for the decade ahead. Again, you know, I do want to note that we have been discussing ever since early 2020 when you wrote a widely circulated article warning about a coming wave of inflation. And that was exactly what we saw. And we were ever since then reiterating that we thought that this inflationary wave would not be transitory, that it would be persistent and stick with us for much longer than officials anticipate, even discussing it for remaining up to a decade or more, which is also something that a number of different guests have reiterated on our show. Russell Napier, also Charles Goodard, and Manoj Pradhan, who wrote the book, The Great Demographic Reversal, and how that relates to inflation. So this is a theme that we've been hammering on for at least a few years now here. But again, tie this into, you know, practical investment tips to think about, not just for this year, but looking out long term.
Well, the first thing is in a disinflationary era, which was the last decade, you know, a lot of the money that the Fed created through QE remained on the balance sheet of the Fed. It did not work its way into the economy in the form of credit. So we didn't have that inflation. And that's why I think the Fed made the mistake. They thought inflation was just transitory. It was a supply chain issue. Once the supply chain got fixed, inflation would go away. Well, that's not the case. As we talked about, fiscal policy is highly inflationary. So in this kind of era, passive investing is no longer working. I mean, if you think of last year, you had the S&P down. Well, the Dow was down 9%. That was the best performing index. The S&P was down over 20. The NASDAQ down over 30. Treasuries and corporates down anywhere from 15 to 25% in bonds. So if you were in a 60-40 portfolio, you really got hammered. I was talking to a potential client that lost, had an $800,000 account and dropped a $500,000 as a result of what happened. It was all in passive index funds. So that's not going to work, nor will the 60-40 work. So one of the things is active investing is now coming back in style. So they're, you know, we use the analogy sailing versus rowing. If everything is going your way in a bull market, you sail. When it isn't, you reef your sails and you row. Or put on your engine. So it's going to be a different kind of market where you will have, I believe, what we're going to see going forward, Chris, is very similar to what we saw between 1966 and 82. You would have brief periods of bull markets that would last 18 months to 2 years. A bear market would follow right back to a bull market. So intermittent markets between bull and bear versus this long, decade-long period where everything went up as we saw in the last decade or in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, and we should mention that during that 1966 to 1982 period where the markets essentially traded flat for that entire time in a sideways volatile fashion, you know, active investing really did outperform passive investing. But also in inflation terms, I mean, in nominal terms, the market went nowhere. In real inflation adjusted terms, you were losing a significant amount of money just given how high inflation was at the time. So if we see a similar scenario this decade where markets are essentially trading in a flat or volatile sideways fashion, in real terms, you are likely to be down. So that's, again, why it's important to hedge for higher inflation, which is what we've been discussing, again, ever since 2020 with hard assets.
Yeah, and my favorite form of hedging against inflation, Chris, is I'm a big proponent of dividend investing. And let me explain why. If you take a look at, okay, you have inflation. If you are investing in hoping that the stock market will go up, let's say you're an S&P index fund, that is not going to work in this decade. Now, let me give you an example. We had the bursting of the tech bubble in March of 2000. The NASDAQ hit a peak, and then The NASDAQ lost over 70% of its value in the next 2 years. The S&P was down over 50%. So by the summer of 2002, the markets were down substantially, especially the NASDAQ. Then the markets went up as Greenspan brought interest rates down to 1% on the Fed funds rate. We went up to September of 2007 when the market peaked. Then the market lost. The S&P lost 60% from September of 2007 to March of 2009. And it would not be to 2013 when you broke even. So let's say you put your money in S&P index funds in the year 2000. Chris, you virtually made nothing over a 13-year period. The only return that you got being in the market were the dividends. The thing I like about dividends, when you're looking to invest in stocks, if you're not getting into dividend stocks, then your basis for making money is you hope the markets and your stock is going to appreciate. Well, what if it doesn't? Take a look at some of the tech stocks. People forget from the year 2000 till roughly about 2013, tech stocks went nowhere. In fact, the tech companies still generating a lot of cash. They were buying back their stock and it went nowhere. And I remember an article in Barron's that was criticizing the tech companies for spending tens of billions of dollars buying their stock and it went nowhere. The stocks declined. Microsoft went nowhere. None of these companies, Cisco, all of them just basically cratered. And then all of a sudden, the Barron's article said you would have been better off returning money to shareholders and paying dividends. Voila, that very year, all the tech giants start paying dividends, whether it was Apple, whether it was Cisco, whether it was Intel, whether it was Microsoft. So the nice thing about dividends, and this is something I learned studying Warren Buffett. If you look at Buffett, he invests in companies that pay dividends and have high rates of return on equity and free cash flow. He either buys the company entirely or he'll invest and receive the dividends. And so the nice thing about a dividend, Chris, I can't tell you with any degree of certainty where the stock market's going to be a year from now. But let's say I own Coca-Cola or Procter & Gamble. I have a higher degree of confidence that I know what my income is going to be at the end of the year and how much of a dividend increase I'm going to get, especially when you're investing in dividend aristocrats, companies that have raised their dividend every year for 25 years. And this is exactly what we did in our dividend income fund. We've been averaging anywhere from 9 to 10% last year. Our dividends were up 11.5%. Plus, on top of that, we're getting dividend yields of 3.5 to 4. That is more predictable in terms of managing inflation versus sitting there and saying, well, I'm in an S&P index fund or I bought a growth stock. I hope it goes up. I have more confidence in what I'll be receiving in dividends and dividend increases than I will in terms of where the stock market's going to be or what an index fund's going to be. So that's why I like dividend investing. I think it's a better inflation hedge. And finally, I think this is a commodity super cycle. As I mentioned, a lot of these commodities are in short supply, low inventories. And that's one of the reasons that we're invested, at least I know right now, I'm over 30% invested in high quality commodity type companies, from big oil companies to big mining companies. And Chris, I'll probably be taking that up to 35%. I'm very, very bullish on oil, copper, and silver this decade. I think they're going to be super investments to hold for the long term. You can't have green without copper and silver, and you can't run an economy without oil and natural gas. So natural gas we need not only for heating, but we also need natural gas for fertilizer. And 80% of this global economy still runs on fossil fuels. So you're going to have to change your reference points, your change of mind, because this is going to be a different decade. And if you don't, you could be like that potential client that lost over 30% of their net worth last year, because there could be more of those periods ahead of us.
As always, today's podcast is brought to you by Financial Sense Wealth Management, named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. If you have any questions about our asset management or financial planning services, feel free to click where it says Contact Us on financialsense.com, or you can call us directly at 888-486-3939. Once again, that number is 888-486-3939.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we want to wish you a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.